from KXJZ in Sacramento. I'm Jeffrey Callison. When We Were Colored is a memoir of life before integration. The 90-year-old author and her daughter join us to tell you about the story behind this moving book today on Insight. Also today, music of the Holocaust era. It's the theme of the next Sacramento Youth Symphony concert. You'll hear stories from a local concentration camp survivor and music from a local klezmer band that will play at the concert. Plus, pianist George Winston. His latest album is homage to the people and music of New Orleans. First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, why the Sacramento Youth Symphony's next concert features music of the Holocaust era. Plus, the folk pianist George Winston joins us. He plays two Northern California concerts this weekend. First, Eva Rutland has achieved a lot in her 90 years, but perhaps her greatest recognition is coming now with the reissue of her 1964 memoir, When We Were Colored. It tells the story of her life before integration. Eva Rutland was born in Atlanta, Georgia, but as a young woman, she moved to Sacramento with her husband, William Rutland, and they raised their family here. That family includes daughter Ginger Rutland, an editorial writer at the Sacramento Bee, and it was she who arranged for the reissue of When We Were Colored. Both are in our studio. Eva Rutland, Ginger Rutland, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Eva, when you wrote this book back in 1964, who were you writing it for?
I was writing it for other mothers, mostly the white mothers. I wanted them to know that we loved our children just as much as they loved theirs.
Go ahead.
And, well, we had a problem. Being colored was different, and it really wasn't any different. I wanted white mothers to know that our children were just as precious as theirs, just as good, too.
Now, at that time, were you friends with many white mothers?
Oh, yes. When I wrote, I have always been friends with white and black because of the peculiar neighborhood I lived in when I was a little girl. Even in Atlanta, my grandfather had been a slave, and I lived in a house that he built soon after the Civil War. There were lots of rich Jews who lived around it, and then during the Depression, the neighborhood had deteriorated. A lot of poor people had moved in. Three or four white families occupied the big houses near me. And there were very few colored families that lived around me. And, well, I just got associated with everybody.
This was your first book, but it had a different title when you first wrote it. What was the title then?
The Trouble with Being a Mama. Which is the title I like. But my Ginger, she liked being colored. So that's why we changed it.
Okay, well, that's a good time to bring Ginger into the conversation. Ginger, why the change in title?
The book was really written during the 1950s and the early 60s when we were called colored. We've been called so many things. But at that time, the polite phrase was colored. And I thought it evoked the era that she talked about, the era when we were colored.
Well, if you were colored, what does that mean? How do you see yourself today, Eva? What word do you use to describe yourself, if any?
Oh, colored? I don't care. That the word doesn't matter. I just think that all people are alike, and all of these differences that we make don't make us really different. And I just liked it. That's the reason I wanted it to be a mama, because all mamas have the same problem.
Now, when you moved to California, what did you make of life here? Did it seem better, worse, or just the same as life elsewhere?
Well, I loved Atlanta because it was where I grew up. But I think when I got to Sacramento, I liked it better than anywhere else we had been. We had lived in Ohio. And I loved the look of Sacramento. It was such a nice, peaceful country town. It's not that today, but it was, when we came, it was a lovely, lovely town. I loved it with the fruit trees all around. And so many different people, so many different nationalities. And it was a different place from Atlanta, but it was, I guess I liked it a little better than any other place other than Atlanta.
Eva Rutland is author of When We Were Colored. It's her 1964 memoir, just recently republished. And the republication was organized by her daughter, Ginger Rutland, who's also with us. Ginger, as you might know, is an editorial writer at the Sacramento Bee. Ginger, we have a reading for the book, and this is from a chapter called You Have to Be Rich. Can you tell us just a little bit about where we are in the book and then read it for us, please?
All right. This is a story about a Christmas. Mom, like moms everywhere, worried about Christmas being too commercial, that it was all about buying and getting and buying and getting. And so she wanted us to experience the joy of giving at Christmas. So she had us do chores. And we had, you know, a very little money between us. I think one person had of the four children, one had $1.35 and one had $2.25. And we went out shopping to the 5 and 10. And we had to buy Christmas presents for everyone in the family. So with your $2.25, you were to buy 5 gifts for the other 5 members of the family. And so this is Christmas morning, and this is what Mom is worried about as she writes. One thing bothered me. What about Christmas morning? Would the little gifts selected with such love and care be ignored and lost among the big things, the cowboy suit, the cradles and dolls? I was, oh, so careful Christmas morning to make a big display over mine, a red wreath and Christmas bell for my coat lapel, a bottle of perfume encased in a toy telephone, 2 barrettes for my hair, a handkerchief. How loudly I loved them all. But I needn't have worried. Billy was as grateful for the 42-cent pop gun from Elsie as he was for the $9.95 gun and holster set. And there were as many expressions from the others. Oh, Patty Joe, thank you. Oh, Billy, you knew I would want this, didn't you? My doubts were really dispelled when Ginger came to me, carefully holding the necklace from Patty Joe. Mama, will you please keep this in your jewelry box for me? And when Elsie wore the bracelet constantly for 2 whole weeks, the one Billy knew she would love. And when Daddy said quite truthfully that the clothes brush from Ginger was the most useful and needed gift in the house. And there was the other thing. There was Billy, 2 days after Christmas, standing before me and saying, Santa Claus didn't really bring us those presents. You and Daddy bought them. I started to protest, but I looked at Billy and he was smiling, and the smile seemed to say, I know. I know how lovingly and with what care you chose the cowboy suit and the football. I even know how it was about the bike you didn't buy. I know because I went shopping too. And then I smiled back. For these were not the disillusioned eyes of a little boy saying goodbye to Santa Claus. These were the eyes of a little boy saying hello to the giving, the getting, the thoughtfulness, the pure loving kindness of Christmas. The eyes of a little boy who had really shared. And I said then, God bless the 5 and 10. It was a real wrench for me to pass up the 5 and 10 when the pickets were there. You know, the brave young people that decided segregation was wrong anywhere, schools, bus stations, lunch counters, and picketed all over the country. But pass it up I did. This was bigger than my pocketbook. These young people were bigger than me, and I would not let them down.
Wow, that's Ginger Rutland reading from her mother's memoir, When We Were Colored. Both Ginger and her mother, Eva Rutland, are with us in the studio. And Eva can no longer see, and that's why Ginger's reading on her behalf. Eva, do you remember writing that?
You know, I didn't. It sounded something like something absolutely new to me. I wrote it a long, long time ago. Don't tell anybody I'm 90 years old.
Oh, sorry, let that one out earlier.
Sorry. You're not supposed to.
Ginger, do you remember that Christmas?
I remember that Christmas very, very, very well. and it was joyful. It really was. The idea of, we had so little money, but we would go to the 5 and 10, all four of us together, crawling all over the place, buying gifts for each other, and then we would go home and wrap them up and hide them for Christmas. It was fun. I thought that was a great idea of Mom's.
Eva, you have been writing for many, many decades, although this was your first book. What did your family, your parents, let's say, and for that matter, your husband and your kids think about your writing?
Well, my husband, I don't know. I don't think they thought much about it. This was the first book, and I didn't write anymore until I started going blind. And then I just began to write the kind of stories that I love to read, which are love stories, the romances, you know, the nice boy meets girls, happy ever after books.
And you've written about 20 of those.
Yes, I love those. And I love the Regencies, because Pride and Prejudice is my favorite book in the whole world. And I wanted to write about things like that.
Ginger, were you aware when you were a kid that your mother was observing things and making notes and writing?
Do you know, I really wasn't. I was really very, very young when much of this book was written in the early 50s. I was, you know, in some instances, I wasn't born yet. And this book, When We Were Colored, A Mother's Story, was written mostly in the early 50s, and I was unaware that she was observing all of these things around her. But what she was observing was, frankly, us, her children, fitting into an integrated world, a world that she did not have to deal with. As a young woman, she grew up in the segregated South, and her close friends were other Black friends, and her social set were other Black people within Atlanta, the better class of Black people in Atlanta, the Black doctors and teachers and pharmacists and that sort of, those sorts of people. And then she comes west to integration, and she's suddenly, her children are confronted with this very difficult thing called integration. And that's really what she's writing about. She says she was terrified that her children would be hurt by white people who did not accept them and did not care about them. And that's what she wanted. That's why she wanted to write. She wanted to tell white mothers, please be nice to my kids.
Eva, how do you think your family's life would have been different if you and William had never moved west, if you'd stayed in Georgia?
Oh, I think I would have been very, very isolated. I never would have experienced the kind of things that I have experienced because I married William Rutland. I became to an integrated society, and I met all kinds of people, and we lived in Germany for a while, and I think I'm just finally got out into the world instead of being closed with Atlanta's Black elite, which was what I thought was the perfect place to be.
Having been raised at the time that you were in Georgia, did you ever think when you were young that America would become an integrated society?
Never. I never thought that would. I was very segregated in Atlanta, but because I lived in a very different neighborhood, I did recognize that people were people, and all people were just alike. I lived around as many white as Blacks, even as a little girl in Atlanta.
And
my closest friend as a little boy was just a little white boy. I don't know why his mother and my mother were very, very close, but I had, even in my little neighborhood in Atlanta, I had white as well as Black friends.
Now, you said that you wrote the book so that white mothers could understand about your life and your family's life. Still, was there anything that the white mothers you knew, your peers, just could never understand about your life here in California?
No, I think that most of them really understood about me. I really do. I think that mothers really basically have the same problems.
Ginger, you were going to say something?
You know, there is a story in the book that I found interesting, and as the book's been republished, I don't think people understood the kinds of economic strains that Black people were under. For example, my parents, like other middle-class parents, wanted to buy a house. But because we were Black, we were not allowed to buy a house in the better neighborhoods, even though we could afford it. So in the end, we had to use subterfuge to buy a house. And that was true for most of our Black friends. So
how do you mean subterfuge?
Well, we had to find they kept trying to buy a house, but there were what they call racial covenants, meaning that there were laws on the deeds. They're embedded within the deeds were promises that the owner would not sell the home to someone of color or to Jews or any other disfavored minority. So in the end, my parents ended up building their own home. But even then, it was difficult because they built their home, their dream home, in an integrated neighborhood, and nobody would, they couldn't buy the lot. So my mother went to a colleague of my father's who worked with him at McClellan and said, Hernley Madeira was his name, "Hern, I want to buy this lot, but they won't sell it to me. Will you buy it for me?" And Hernley Madeira, my father, my parents' white friend, said, "Sure, I will." And that's what he did. And that's how my parents were able to buy their home. I don't think most white people in Sacramento who were going about their lives were aware of the kinds of barriers that existed for Blacks at that time, the economic barriers, the social barriers.
Eva, that must have been a very tough experience for you and your husband to have to ask a favor like that of white people you knew so that you could do something as basic and fundamental as build a home.
Yeah, but the white people were just as aware of the problem as we were. And we were very lucky that we were friends and that they could sympathize with us and not be afraid to buy the house for us. I think we were very lucky. We had very good friends, white and Black.
Eva, are you still writing?
I'm trying to, but I'm getting old and feeble.
She says that's not true. This is a great writer. I got to tell you, she can write circles around me. And it's amazing how she does it. I mean, physically, how she is able to do it.
Well, tell us, Eva, how do you physically write today?
Well, I write on a computer. Ginger gave showed me how to use a computer. And It's a little dated. You know, the machinery changes every day, and I can't keep up with it.
Yes.
So I'm with the old-fashioned computer, but I have two guys, Lou and Randy, who fix my computer for me, and they're saving another old one, so if it runs out, I'll have something to write on.
But, Mom, you're not telling them the important part. It has a voice synthesizer.
Oh, yeah, it has a voice synthesizer. So I can type something, it'll read it back to me, and I can go back and change it. It's very, very convenient for me. Much better than my typewriter.
Yes.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. And I think we should explain for listeners who are wondering what that hissing sound is, that the hissing sound when you speak, Eva, is, what is that?
Tell them about my tracheotomy tube. I've got all the ailments in the world. I've got a tracheotomy tube because my vocal cords were paralyzed and I couldn't get enough breath. So that's the only way I can get a breath. And I have to put my finger up there to close it up to talk. It's extremely inconvenient.
But she's been doing this inconvenient thing since before I was born. So it's been some while, and she's done okay. Blind, tracheotomy tube. She still lived a very full life.
But well, I'd like for my daughter to do my publicity from now on. I'm not a very good publicity lady.
Well, Ginger's pretty good at that. Take my word for that. The book is called When We Were Colored, A Mother's Story. It was written by Eva Rutland. She wrote it many years ago. It's just republished, and the republication was organized by Eva's daughter, Ginger Rutland. Eva, Ginger, it was great to see you both. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, music of the Holocaust era. It's the theme of the next Sacramento Youth Symphony concert. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Music of the Holocaust era is the theme of the next Sacramento Youth Symphony concert. It happens this weekend and will feature stories along with music performed by the symphony and a local klezmer band. Let's start with the man who leads the Sacramento Youth Symphony, Michael Newman. Michael, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you very much for having us on.
Why is the Sacramento Youth Symphony devoting a whole concert, and there's a lot to this concert, to music of the Holocaust era?
Well, we performed this concert back in 2005, and it resonated so big with the audience that we decided that really we needed to do this again. Obviously, it resonated in such a way that we just felt the need that we should do this one more time.
Okay, apparently we had a problem with the microphone there, but we'll continue. So how did you put this together? Was this your idea?
Well, doing this concert, yes, was my idea quite a few years ago, actually. It started out just as a concert where we played some music from the Holocaust era, but it evolved and grew into this multimedia-type event that my idea was to do something that had such great significance that it would make an impact on people, and clearly it has done that, and for that I'm very grateful.
Mm. And there are a lot of elements to this. Give us an idea of what's happening.
Well, it will be a multimedia presentation. It will trace the story of the Holocaust through music, the different periods pre-1933, happy-go-lucky times, into the pre-war progressive jazz sort of idiom, and then into the ghetto and partisan period. And this is where the Freilachmakers will play two songs about resistance, and into the concentration camp period, where we will tell the stories. Again, there will be words spoken, there will be images on the big screen, there will be lighting. So it is truly a multimedia production.
Mm. Now, one person whose story is told, at least in part in the concert, is with us, Frank Rothman, a concentration camp survivor. Frank, welcome to Insight.
It's my pleasure to be here.
You're from where originally?
I was born in Czechoslovakia, but later on we were occupied by Hungary in 1938.
And you actually spent time in several camps. Could you tell us where you were and when?
Yes, I was in four different concentration camps. Among them, Auschwitz. That was the biggest camp. And then second camp, I was in Mauthausen, then in Germany near Flossburg. And then I was put on a dead march, taken to the last camp, Theresienstadt, where I was liberated. As a matter of fact, 3 days ago was my 62nd anniversary of my liberation.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
How many years were you in the camps overall?
In the camps, different camps, I was over 1 year, and before there, for a short time, in the ghetto of the city where I was living.
How did you manage to survive all these stays in all of these camps?
You know, I talked to schools about the Holocaust, and they asked me similar questions. I say I survived, and I only have one word for it. I survived by luck, nothing else, by luck.
Did you have? Was there anything that you did to help ensure your survival?
Well, I was born into a family. My parents were very religious, so I kept my faith, and the faith plus the thoughts that I may and I hope that I will see my family again, that kept me going.
And how many family members and friends of yours survived, if any?
I'm lucky that I have several brothers who survived concentration camps. I had also two sisters and a brother who escaped to Bolivia, South America, also survived. You see, we were 11 siblings home. So we were a big family. But I'm very grateful that fate was good to me, that we survived, as many of us as we did. Because most of the families were lucky if just one of them survived.
We're talking with Frank Rothman. He lives in the Sacramento area, but he's a concentration camp survivor. And his story, and among others, is told in this weekend's concert by the Sacramento Youth Symphony. It's called Music of the Holocaust Era. There's music and stories. Frank, how long were you confined to the ghetto before the camps?
5 weeks.
5 weeks. Yes. What was life like there?
Well, compared to what came later, was not so bad. But we lived under inhuman conditions. There were 14,000 people on a very small area because it was outside of the city where the ghetto was. Actually, on open fields where we were confined. And those 5 weeks were terrible, of course. We slept on the bare grounds. There was no water to wash up. We still had food to eat. But it was a situation hard to describe. You saw children roaming around, older people laying on the ground. We didn't know what's going to happen to us. So it was terrible. But of course, the big blow came later when they decided to empty the ghetto. They put us, they actually assembled us, 2,000 people in a group, took us to the railroad station, put us into cattle cars, 100 person in one cattle car, and they shipped us to Auschwitz.
When did you realize what was ahead of you when you were living in the ghetto? At what point did you realize that terrible places were ahead of you?
Well, most of us, were informed what went on in Germany, later in Poland, in occupied Russia. We heard and we knew about the atrocities, but we were kind of lucky that we were not bothered in the beginning of the war, but we were informed what's going on around us. So we were always afraid that someday may happen to us, but we did not know the extent of the suffering, the extent of the concentration camp. We never heard about Auschwitz or Birkenau, those concentration camps. We heard about Dachau, Buchenwald, but we didn't know everything what later on, unfortunately, we had to experience.
Michael Newman, how did you or other people with the symphony incorporate the stories of Frank and other survivors in the Music of the Holocaust Era concert?
Well, it just seemed very appropriate to use reality and real events and real people to be able to tell the story as opposed to doing it in some sort of a nebulous fashion. So we're here in Sacramento. This is the Sacramento Youth Symphony. It made sense to use local people, to use local stories to incorporate into this multimedia concert. And so that's what we've done. It took a lot of research there's tons and tons of stuff written about the Holocaust. There's thousands of books, there's thousands of movies, etc. So it took a quite a great deal of learning about what to do, how to put it together, and it really did over time evolve into this multimedia production. I mean, one could ask what one of the pieces we'll play is Eine kleine Nachtmusik. And you could say, well, what the heck does Eine kleine Nachtmusik have to do with the Holocaust? Well, the fact is the Women's Orchestra of Auschwitz played that piece, and that is why we play that piece, and it's interwoven into the story, and it's all explained to the audience visually on the screen why we do each piece, and it goes from, again, pre-1933 happy-go-lucky times until the foundation of the State of Israel, which was really created in 1948 out of the ashes of the Holocaust.
Also in the concert is a klezmer band. They're called the Freilach Makers Klezmer String Band, and one of the members, the founder, Andy Rubin, is with us. Andy, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the sound that your band makes. We're going to listen to an excerpt of a recording, but I got to say, when I first listened to your band, it wasn't quite what I expected.
Well, first of all, we are, in our inception, a string band. We were string-based, which actually represented much of how klezmer music was played in Eastern Europe. It was basically a musical form that arose to play weddings, and it was battened down by a violin and by a cymbal, which is the Eastern European Yiddish name for a hammer dulcimer. And our idea in starting this band was that we would do the American form of a klezmer string band. So we have a banjo. And that's pretty much how we started. Now, since that time, 12 years ago, we've added a clarinet, an accordion. So we're pretty much a klezmer band.
Well, one of the songs that your band plays in the Music of the Holocaust era concert, I believe, is a Yiddish song called Still die Nacht.
Right.
And we have an excerpt of it. Let's listen.
Ist euch gestellen und der Frost hat stark gebrennt. Sie gedenkst du, wie ich hab dich gelernt. Halten a Speier in der Hand. Sie gedenkst du, wie ich hab dich
Now, the title sounds a bit like Stille Nacht, the famous German Christmas song. Is there any connection, or is it just coincidence?
Not that I know of. We don't translate it Silent Night. We translate it Silent is the Night or Still is the Night. And this song was written by Hirsch Glick, who was a very young poet from Vilna, who took part in the resistance movement against the Nazis out in the woods outside in Belarus and Lithuania.
Now, how's your band, the Freilach Makers Klezmer String Band, integrated into this otherwise orchestral concert?
Well, as I understand it, we are to represent sort of the street-level resistance to the Nazis, as opposed, say, to a higher cultural level represented by the symphony orchestra. Mm. And these two songs that we're doing are songs that were sung by the resistance fighters out in the woods of Belarus and Lithuania.
And what does it do for you personally, taking part in a concert like this?
I'm incredibly honored, and we all in our band are incredibly honored to be part of this, because we feel that we are being allowed to be part of the transmission of this history, which needs to be transmitted to every generation in as lively and as alive manner as possible.
And Frank Rothman, this concert's been done before 2 years ago. How do you rate what Michael and the others have done putting this together?
Well, I am very grateful to Maestro Newman when he put together that concert 2 years ago. I had the pleasure to talk to the young people, the members of the Sacramento Youth Symphony, about 4 weeks ago. And I told the young people that through their music, through the voices of the instrument, they are going to honor and remember those who suffered and those who were killed during the Holocaust. So I was grateful, and I told them that I thank them doing that. And I also am very grateful to Mr. Newman, who is doing that, because I feel that he's remembering not only his great parents who died in Auschwitz. By the way, Mr. Newman's great parents maybe were guests in the same gas chamber that my mother, my father, and my family were guests. So it's very close to me what they are doing. And I feel that they are, again repeating myself, honoring and remembering not so much us survivors, but those millions who were slaughtered, Jews and not Jews, during the Holocaust. And I cannot express enough my gratefulness to them to doing that.
Michael, when does the concert happen?
The concert happens this weekend, Sunday evening, 7 o'clock at the Mondavi Center. And it is a very it's very exciting to be able to do something like a concert of this nature. And I hope it has some great meaning to the people who are there.
Well, thank you all very much. The man you just heard, Michael Newman, he's the artistic director and conductor of the Sacramento Youth Symphony. Also Frank Rothman, you heard just before Michael, concentration camp survivor. And Andy Rubin, before that, member of the Freilach Makers Klezmer String Band, which will perform in the concert Music of the Holocaust Era this Sunday evening at the Mondavi Center. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, pianist George Winston. His latest album is homage to the people and music of New Orleans. We're going out with the Sacramento Youth Symphony playing the theme from Exodus. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. George Winston's folk piano style, evocative of the sounds and rhythm of nature, has inspired fans around the world since the early 70s. But Winston's piano influences extend beyond folk. He's also a lifelong admirer of the music of New Orleans, and you can hear that on his latest album, Gulf Coast Blues and Impressions, a benefit album for the survivors of Hurricane Katrina. George Winston is about to play two concerts in Northern California, Benicia on Saturday and Vacaville on Sunday. This afternoon, he joins us by phone to talk about his music. George Winston, welcome to Insight.
Hi, Jeffrey. Nice to be with you today, and nice to hear that wonderful interview you just did with the Yiddish musicians. I wish I could be at those shows. I'm just not in the area.
Well, indeed. Now, how did you come up with your unique musical sound? It goes back to the early 70s, does it not?
Yeah, I was inspired by the Doors in 1967 to start playing, and I started on organ. And then I heard Fats Waller's recordings from the 20s and 30s in 71, and I was inspired to switch to solo piano instead of organ. And then I developed the folk piano. Fats Waller is well known for being one of the greatest proponents of the stride piano, the hot jazz style of the 20s and 30s, put on the piano. And that means the left hand strides or jumps between a bass and a chord while the right hand plays improvisation. So it's really a band style piano band style from the 30s, or band style piano from the 20s and 30s. And I developed the folk piano because I wanted the opposite. I wanted something that was melodic, simpler, and used the part of the piano that has that wonderful sustain that the piano has. So I developed that and came up with that in 71. And then finally in 79, I heard Professor Longhair, and I'm still studying the great New Orleans pianists, Professor Longhair, James Booker, Henry Butler, who I'm seeing in concert tonight's part of the San Francisco Jazz Festival tonight at the Earps Theater, so I get to see my main man tonight. And also studying Dr. John and John Cleary. Dr. John's the best known of the great New Orleans pianists, and also Alan Toussaint, who I'm also seeing tonight. He's on double bill with Henry Butler, so it's great we're talking about New Orleans pianists today, because I'm seeing two of my favorites tonight. So, and I've been studying them ever since, and the main music I work on really is from the inspiration of James Booker, Henry Butler, and Dr. John, all from New Orleans. And this latest record, Gulf Coast Blues and Impressions, it does benefit New Orleans. Yes. And the Gulf Coast groups are helping people to return and rebuild. And yes. I've done some benefit shows, and I've played down in Gulfport. The devastation is you have to see it. It's amazing.
You know? You mentioned
amazing. More people, you know, didn't get killed. It's just astounding. You know, at least you have a warning with the hurricanes, and people are able to get out of the way. But it's something else.
You mentioned James Booker and Henry Butler, and there are songs by them on the Gulf Coast album. And let's listen to a bit of Pixie, which was written by James Booker. That's Pixie, performed by my guest George Winston from his latest album, Gulf Coast Blues and Impressions. In the liner notes, you say that James Booker is a pianist who has influenced my overall piano playing the most. What is it about his style that influenced you the most?
Well, he was an organist as well, and I started out on organ, and I can hear that influence in his piano playing. And I've always thought of the piano as, well, I'm thinking organ, but I'm playing piano. I want to play and have it be acoustic, and that nothing's helping me, and I'm doing it all. But I'm still thinking organ. I want that sustain. I want that growl. I want that those things that the organ. So the organ inspires me to get as many sounds out of the piano as I can that I hear inside myself that I want. And James Booker just, I just heard him, and I went, that's the way to play the piano. That's what I've been. I heard his recordings in 82, and I went, I love Professor Longhair. In fact, I love Professor Longhair so much, I'm going to do a whole album of his pieces. That's why there's no Professor Longhair pieces on this record, by the way.
You're saving him.
I'm saving them all. I do have a tribute song to him on called Blues for Fess Beloved. Fess was his nickname for Professor. And but I heard James Booker, and I went, you know, it just struck me instantaneously, that approach. So then I started just listening to all, you know, Beatles songs, all the songs I could. What songs do I want to play? And James Booker really gave me the means to approach the piano with that post-World War II rhythm and blues sensibility. Stride piano is really pre-World War II. And, you know, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, so it really, 50s and 60s is really much more who I am than 20s and 30s. I mean, 20s, 30s. Inspiration really filled me up as a listener, but not, I didn't live during that era. There's something about being there at that time that it's just more part of me. And Henry Butler is the one I've been studying the most since 85, and what I do is he gives me the means to add to the James Booker influence. Henry Butler's kind of more what you'd call funk, And James Booker's a previous generation, and you'd really call him rhythm and blues. Henry Butler's also the only pianist I personally know of that plays the real mainstream jazz and the real hardcore R&B and blues. And
well, let's hear your interpretation of The Breaks, which is by Henry Butler. You say in the liner notes that Butler has taken R&B piano to its ultimate height. What has he done that's brought the piano, that kind of piano, to its height?
In my view, he just took inspiration from Professor Longhair, James Booker, and just took it farther. Maybe in a way like Einstein built on Newton and Newton built on Copernicus and that kind of thing. It just, for me, I've been studying it for 22 years, and maybe I'm 30% of the way of what I want to incorporate from his influence. And it's just, it's kind of unspeakable for me. I think once you hear him live, too, if you can hear Henry Butler live, it's just something else. It's different every time. It's, can't really quite put my finger on it. It's technical, but feeling incorporated, you know, he's a generation younger than James Booker, so there's maybe more information. Also, he brings more of a jazz influence, since he is a jazz player, and is, like I said, the only one I know of that does both. And James Booker is an interesting thing on that song you played, Pixie. You can hear where the lower note of the left hand playing is the organ bass pedal part, and the right hand, the upper part of the left hand, I'm sorry, the lower part of the left hand is kind of the organ bass pedal part. The upper part of the left hand is a rhythm part, and he's playing licks and melody with the right hand, but he also throws in a chord occasionally, so he's kind of got four things going. I picked up on that right away. And and James Booker inspired Henry Butler a lot. They knew each other in New Orleans, and it's just a lineage. You know, this New Orleans piano lineage goes from Louis Gottschalk from the 1850s all the way up through Henry Butler now. It's just an amazing continuum.
There's another song on your album, Gulf Coast Blues and Impressions, called Stevenson, which is dedicated to a late friend of yours, a New Orleans filmmaker, Stevenson Palfy, who made a film called Piano Players Rarely Ever Play Together. Is that true?
Yes, that was just an incredible film about Professor Longhair and an older pianist that inspired him, three generations pianist, Isidore Toots Washington, who inspired Professor Longhair, who inspired Alan Toussaint. Toussaint, it's really, I heard it both ways, but Alan Toussaint, it was in that film as well, who again, I'm going to see tonight wonderfully. And I'd never seen Professor Longhair passed on before I ever got to see him, so it gave me a view. And Stevens became a dear friend of mine, and he's one of the, you know, passed on, one of the Katrina casualties.
Yeah.
You know, just such a thinking of him, that song just kind of emerged.
Now, in your concerts this weekend, what kind of music are you going to be focusing on? This New Orleans style, or your folk piano as well, or something else?
Oh, both. I have two concerts. I do summer show and winter show, and I try to alternate each time I play someplace. So it was the winter show last time, fall and winter type things. So this will be the summer show. What I regard as spring and summer type things. Basically, yeah, some of the New Orleans piano, some things from this recording. Some of the melodic folk piano, some of Vince Guaraldi's Peanuts pieces, kind of a where I'm at musically right now, basically. And be at the Vacaville Performing Arts Center in Vacaville on Sunday 13. On Saturday, tomorrow night, I'll be at Benicia at the Majestic Theater. So it's just great to be back in the area.
Well, very good. Well, George Winston, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks,
I appreciate
Jeffrey.
It.
Jeffrey. Wonderful show. I've been listening to most of the show, so it's wonderful what you guys are doing.
Thank you very much. That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more information about the guests and topics you hear on Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Insight's theme was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producers, Robin Souza and Rosalind Gottfried. Our technical director is Mark Jones, the assistant producer, Natalie Breen, senior producer, Jen Picard, and Insight's executive producer is Carl Watanabe. Thanks for joining us. We're going out with George Winston's New Orleans Shall Rise Again. Criminal justice professor Mickey Bolden has written about criminals and terrorism, but our new book about cooking for cancer patients is closest to her heart. On the next Insight, hear about the movement she's trying to start to get communities cooking. Also, why is the liberal Sacramento News and Review printing paid inserts from the conservative Sacramento Union? We'll talk with the editors. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
That's Monday afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.